This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Roseanne Cash. She is a Grammy-winning singer-songwriter and author. I spoke with her on November 17th, 2011, in the rehearsal room at Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis. This interview is included in our show, Roseanne Cash, Time Traveler. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Yeah, you're on twice in New York. I think you're on. Are you on Sunday mornings in New York? No, well, you're on early Sunday morning.
Early Sunday morning on 10 p.m. Sunday night at 3 p.m. Saturday.
Well, see, that's actually, I hear you either early Sunday morning or Sunday night because you're sitting in some, in my little office paying bills and stuff, and I turn on a VR and that's fine.
And you zen out while you're paying bills.
I do. I love your show. I do. I love it. The minute you told me you were just like, you gotta do this show.
That's great.
That might be a new fundraiser.
Oh, it's Alyssa. Zen
out while you're paying
bills. Hey, Alyssa.
Should we go ahead and sit down?
Yeah,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay.
I think some tea was made for you. Is that all right?
Yes.
Is that what you want? Okay.
Yeah. I think she's bringing a little milk,
that's okay,
too.
That's cool.
Yeah, she ran.
Do we have any more coasters? Because we need one for both,
for the
glasses and the tea.
Yeah,
so I interviewed Bobby McFerrin right here as well, just
a
couple months ago. And so there's no pressure to sing or to pick up your guitar. But it's just there if you feel like it. Because, you know, when we create the show, we can layer music in lavishly.
Yeah.
But I just wanted you to have it,
there,
in case
right.
you want to.
All right. It's there, so it's, you know.
Yeah. All right. So
it's bound to be used.
I think he's got a pretty heavy load tonight.
But I want to make it easy for you, so in terms of like where mics are placed and things,
mm-hmm.
this can slide
yeah.
from you to getting guitar and
sure.
all that.
All right.
Feel free to do that.
Oh, how nice. Thank you.
And John gave us a little solo warming up here. So
oh, good. He probably tuned it for me as
he
well.
He did tune it for you.
So nice to me. Just tell Bryn.
Is that your kids? Is that your
Jake, kids? Yeah. Scott.
I have that too, somehow.
No.
When I'm, wherever I am, I'm organizing their lives.
I know.
Right?
Doesn't matter. Europe, Japan.
Yeah. I get these calls and. Well, I'm just going to.
Check 1, 2, check
okay.
1, 2, February, March.
See, she's a pro.
April, May.
What did I have for lunch? Nuts, cheese, what
that
I
sounds
could
like
scavenge.
My lunch.
I didn't have any real food in my house.
Figs, pistachios, banana.
I'm big on walnuts
these
days.
Oh, no, I had root salad. My husband got me root salad.
He tunes your guitar. He gets
He's
you
so
root
nice
salad.
To me.
This
not
is...
It's nice to me.
For anyone in the room who's got a cell phone on, if we could
oh,
go away.
You know what? Where's my purse? I don't know if it's.
Right here.
If you can't find it.
Can I look for it? Or
you can look for it, but you might get bitten.
You know, my wife is.
Yeah. Trent's a good husband, too. Okay. My daughter texting me. Okay. Well, I'm so glad to be here. So glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Are we ready? Or do we need to... Tell me this. Are we going to need to do that change tape thing?
Yeah. Okay. And I'll wait. There's a clock right over there.
All right. We have to change. Yeah.
So at about 50, quarter after, I think would actually be a good time.
Quarter after?
5:30 to 5:30 would be a good time.
All right. Okay. And we're going to kind of shoot for an hour, but we have time to go over if we're just really into this and want to keep going, if that's all right. Should we go? I don't know where I'm not going to look anywhere. This, all this technology, I really like radio. I really like just the human voice, and technology is inserting pictures into everything and cameras. And I just try to ignore them. So, you know, I want to start, or I start with everybody. I start here with quantum physicists or theologians. And I know that you have a really interesting answer to this question. I just want to hear a little bit about the religious and spiritual background that was there in your childhood.
Well, both of my parents were very religious. My mother was a strict Catholic, and my father was a Southern Baptist. So they had very particular views. My mother was a little more dogmatic. She really believed that Catholicism was the right way. My father, even though he was a Southern Baptist, he was a mystic. You know, he really looked for the mystical in religion and in all of life. So he just kind of channeled his mysticism into Southern Baptist religion, because that's how he was brought up.
He was kind of Pentecostal too, right?
No.
Where
he
did
wasn't
I read that?
No.
Okay, because there's a mystical strain to that.
Yeah, I think that he may have gone to a church for a while, a Pentecostal church, but you know, he was always looking for where you connected to God.
Yeah,
you know, art, music, religion.
Right. Some of those. Those Protestant, I mean, I grew up Southern Baptist in Oklahoma, and there's a way in which I think a lot of people don't realize, I mean, the emphasis in some of those traditions on speaking to God directly, which is such a departure from Catholicism, can lend itself to a mysticism, even though we think about mysticism as Catholic saints.
Yeah, well, my mother was very structured about that, you know, the rituals, the rules. It really made her feel safe. It was kind of perfect for her because she was a very structured person. But neither one of those really worked for me.
Right. It sounds like you were more raised, more Catholic.
More Catholic. Mm-hmm. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. It took me a long time to get rid of some of the more pernicious aspects of that, you know. But my father had to sign a paper when he married my mom saying that the children could be raised Catholic. And then when my parents split up and we visited my dad in summer, my mother made him promise that he would take us to Mass on Sundays. So he did. He was very dutiful about that, you know. I have to admire that now. He would sit in the back row and wait for us. And when I was about 15, I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And he said, but, you know, I promise you, I said, I won't tell her if you want. And I could see it was a moral dilemma for him, but he let me stop.
Right. And then the element, which I also think of as a spiritual element of your life, was music, right?
Still is.
There's this phrase in your memoir, a life circumscribed by music. So, you know, what was the shape of that growing up? How would that look like to have a life circumscribed by music?
Well, I was really oppressed by what I thought spirituality was, because I was only exposed to Catholicism, really, and then my dad's religion a bit later on. But it felt very constraining, and a lot of it had to do with feeling bad about myself. You know, the sin, original sin, all of these concepts weighed really heavily on me. I took it seriously. You know, they had the veneer of authority, these people, and it just didn't. It sounded very scary what they were telling me. And it took me a long time to first start shedding the way I had felt, you know, restricted by it and the punitive aspects of it. And then it took me well into my 20s and early 30s to really find something that was mine and to realize that art and music was the kind of deity I was looking for, that it was all there, the source of all creativity, light, enlightenment, beauty, revelation, inspiration. All of those things were in art and music. So I said, well, that's good enough for me. And so then the religion part of it would be, you know, finding that in myself, the authentic version of that.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like you really experienced yourself to be a writer before then you became a writer of music and a musician as well.
Yeah, I started writing. I mean, I loved language from the beginning. I was a kid who asked my mother to drop me at the library on Saturdays. It was really geeky, you know. I just would hole up with a book forever. If they had a toy trade at school, I wanted Heidi, you know, the book. But I didn't think I would become a musician because I thought that meant that you would have a public life and get famous, and I didn't want to do that.
Well, you saw that too.
Yeah. I mean, my mother's version of things was that if you were a musician or performer, you were away from home all the time and you didn't have a private life and you got on drugs and you got divorced and had affairs and, you know, it didn't sound very appealing.
Yeah, which she had, she experienced.
She experienced
that, right?
All of that, right? And then, that was,
you know, I
true
think
for her.
It's so interesting when you describe after graduating from high school, you joined your father's tour, and you also had your own close-up experience of all of that.
Yeah, I know. You know, it was the '80s. I think everybody did drugs in the '80s, and you know, it was. I was a musician. I was around a lot of musicians. But that lifestyle didn't appeal to me. What appealed to me was the hard work to just show up for my job. And if art and music were the religion, then the hard work was the, you know, the dogma.
Yeah. Or the sacrament or the ritual.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The sacrament. That's a better word. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something else that really interested me, I think you wrote about this, especially in your memoir. You talked about how your father, in that experience, you really saw how your father was his best self on stage.
Yes.
And I've known performers also who are incredibly private, but then they kind of come alive on stage. Mm. But something you describe is, it was like there were relational things that happened.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it wasn't just this private
right.
being a performer. And I think that's kind of counterintuitive and maybe also kind of special. I mean.
Well, he was a special performer and he took all of his problems to the stage, to the spotlight. You know, it was like being bathed in light in a literal sense. He really worked things out. He healed things. Mm-hmm. He asked June to marry him on stage,
right,
you know?
Right.
He felt his most natural self on stage, his largest self.
And you also had experiences with him on stage,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I talked about this in my memoir, that this, the last time he played Carnegie Hall and he wanted me to sing a song with him, I Still Miss Someone, which is one of his greatest songs. And I was mad at him for some reason, and I said no. You know, what a brat.
Yeah.
And then I said no like a couple times. He asked me 3 or 4 times, and I kept saying no. And then we were at the hotel about to go to Carnegie Hall, and he asked me once more, and I said no again, and then he turned away, and the look of his back struck me, like, because I had seen that angle of his back from the wings so many times, and it filled me with so much love for him. It really moved me deeply because that's, you know, seeing my dad on stage was seeing my dad. It was really seeing into his soul. So I said, wait, I'll do it. And it worked out like I hoped, you know, like I didn't even know I hoped, but it worked out. I sang with him and it all got fixed.
On stage.
That still happens, you know. Sometimes I'm playing with my husband on stage and we've gotten in an argument or something, or, you know, we're tired and cranky. And it will all get worked out in some solo he plays or some note.
But it's about the music then.
Yeah.
It's not about the spotlights and
no,
the
it's
audience.
About the music.
Yeah,
it's definitely so about the music.
So the music then kind of transcends even that setting. And is that what you're saying? And the fact that they're,
you know, when I first became a performer, I was so anxious about it, and it took me a long time to grow into it because I thought that being a performer was about getting a lot of attention, and I didn't want that much attention.
Right.
I liked the writer's life. I liked the privacy and the solitude and being inside my own little mind cave. And over time, I realized that it's not about the attention. It's about the energy exchange. I'm doing something for them, but they're doing something for me too, you know? And there's no hierarchy, really. Mm. And some nights that exchange is so beautiful, you know? I can feel my own energy stretching out to the far reaches of the room, and theirs coming back, and there's something sublime about it. And also the temporal nature of it, that at the end of the night, it's over.
Right.
It's like a monk's sand painting. It's wiped clean. Mm. And so you can't grab it, you know, which is part of the mystical beauty of it. You can't repeat it. You know, the next night might be just awful. Like
right.
Your energy might not expand beyond 2 feet beyond you, and they're not giving you anything and it doesn't work. But, you know, that's the way life is.
Yeah. It's that spiritual discipline of knowing impermanence.
Right? Knowing impermanence and showing up even though you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised at times? I mean, because, you know, when I read about you, you had a lot of reasons to resist going into that same profession
yes.
that you'd been surrounded with. And you seem to always have been pretty aware of what you didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when somebody reads your biography, then suddenly in the 80s, you start having hit songs.
Yeah.
And it's striking. Did you wake up sometimes and say, how did this happen?
Sure. I still do. the trajectory of my career and my work has been one of spirals. Like, I had a lot of success in the beginning and not a lot of confidence or mastery in what I was doing. I was just kind of fumbling. And that's not to say it wasn't good, you know, my instincts were still good, but there wasn't a lot of mastery. So then later on, I had a lot less success, but I developed more mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And I became comfortable with the idea of not, you know, not having as much success as I'd gotten used to in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It all became fine. It all kind of just focused into what my work was, and the reverberations of that were really beyond my control, you know. And there's a lot of love in that, you know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, my friend Stephen Pressfield, he wrote this great book called The War of Art, and he has this great line in it. He says, you have to show the muse you're serious.
Mm.
You know, you can't just expect to be hit by these beautiful bolts of inspiration and lightning. You have to keep showing up, even if, you know, you don't get hit for a year or 2 years. Just show the muse you're serious.
Hmm.
And then the relationship there feels like love to me. I mean, it feels like the heart opening.
I think my favorite song on the Black Cadillac album is I Was Watching You,
yeah.
Which really is about love.
And time travel.
Yeah, well, it's about love before life and beyond life.
Yeah. That song was really odd in that it started with an image instead of a line. Usually when I'm writing, a phrase or a line or, you know, a couplet will come to me, and that's where this song will start. This song, I was just sitting at the piano and I saw this Texas road with headlights on it. And so that was the first line of the song, Headlights on a Texas Road. And then it started developing. I didn't know where it was going. And then I saw three verses, one before life, one during life, one after life. And that love was the constant, you know, and that what survives of us is love. It's like that Philip Larkin poem, What Survives of Us is Love. So the song was kind of there. Sometimes I think songs are there in the ether, and you just have to have your skills good enough to get them.
Right. You used a phrase somewhere, that the same phrase that Bobby McFerrin used with me, that you catch songs.
Yeah.
Which is a similar
image. I was just going to say, you have your catcher's mitt on.
Which is just fascinating to think about.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm afraid that if I don't get it down, that somebody else will get it.
Yeah, right.
I don't want, you know, I don't want Lucinda to get this one.
Yeah. So, you know, this I didn't expect to think about this, but something that I've talked about with scientists is there's this debate in science about whether, like, say, whether mathematics is invented or discovered. Do we come up with it, or is it, you know, is it somehow in the fabric of the universe and we're able to turn it into an equation? And it seems to me that it's a similar idea
to
what you
just said.
It's the
same thing. And now you've stumbled on an area that I'm endlessly obsessed and fascinated with. Because fractals in nature, that perfection of math, that to me is God. And that's the same thing as art, you know, that there's some creative force that organizes all of these things. And like you just said, we glimpse it. We can just a little bit see it, you know, and understand it. And our math is like the fumblings of a, you know, a toddler trying to talk about something that already exists, that's so perfect and so complicated and full of so much mystery that we can barely touch it.
And, you know, some of the people I trust the most who wrestle with this question of invented or discovered, well, what they'll say is it's both, right? Which a way of talking about creativity as well.
Yeah, sure, because if you don't have the skills to interpret it or bring it into being or create it, you know, then it's somewhere else. It's still out there.
Right.
But it's
lost.
I mean,
there's the image that you got.
Yeah.
The picture of a highway to Texas, and then you turn it into something. And so it's both and.
Well, and then there's also that, you know, the unknown element of genius. There are some people, some writers, some songwriters I admire that I consider genius, and that I'll never be, no matter how hard I worked, I wouldn't have the skills to catch those songs.
You know? Is that how you think of it?
Yes.
Right, and physicists will say only an Einstein could write E=mc².
Right, but I could, you know, I could work on my own skills enough to get the best songs I could possibly get, and that's what I'm doing. That's my life.
So here's something else, and again with the Black Cadillac that I've thought about. Actually, I have a daughter who's becoming a songwriter.
Oh,
so interesting
her.
To watch that. So the song, a really, really religious song, God is in the Roses and the Thorns.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and this is often true of beautiful songs. If that were just a sentence on a page, you know, just
a
line
of
poetry. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very simple. So there's something that you do that's different when you turn words into song, or that the music the music transforms the mere words.
Absolutely. Some of my songs wouldn't stand alone as poetry. Some would, I think. Mm-hmm. Some wouldn't because of the very thing you're talking about, because they're so bound to the melody or the backbeat, you know, that they can't be separated. I'm about to do this project with a painter I know. He wants to use my lyrics and do paintings with them, like include them in the paintings. Mm-hmm. I was a little worried about that in the beginning, like, well, would the lyrics stand alone? Let me pick the lines. <You know? laughs> But, yeah, I mean, that's by nature the definition of songs, is that the music is half of it, at least.
So it means that so the difference is, say, when you were younger and you wanted to be a pure writer, it would have been a different kind of writing. There must be a whole different kind of instinct, intuition, that goes along with writing words that are going to become songs. I'm just fascinated.
Yes.
Yes,
and the way I learned that is by listening to great songwriters. My dad is a truly great songwriter, and the way he uses Southern imagery and... he's one of the greatest in that. And, you know, he's documented these things in time, like Big River. There's that kind of America doesn't exist anymore, where St. Louis to Memphis was an exotic trip, you know. And his use of onomatopoeia and alliteration, you know, in this really instinctive way, that's genius. So listening to those songs changed me, obviously, fundamentally. And listening to the Beatles, the precise song structure, huge impact on me. And then as I got into my teens and 20s, I would write down lyrics that I admired just to see why they worked. Why is that so good? And I had this Bob Dylan book of his lyrics, and I read them over and over, and I would listen to the record and notice if he changed a pronoun or a the or an and that would mean so much to me. And it had great significance, so much so that when I look at these lyric sites online now and I see they've completely mangled my lyrics, it just, I can't
it must
bear
drive
it.
Drive you crazy.
It drives me crazy.
I know what you mean. That has the transcripts as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about
if the way the lines are broken up is important, whether it's an and or a but is important, you know?
And mistakes are really, really a big deal. So did you find this also when you were looking at Bob Dylan lyrics that it would be just as a sentence on a page, it would be trite, but in a song it was...
Well, not him. Some people, yes. Mm-hmm. Generally not Bob.
Mm-hmm.
But you said now that God is in the Roses was the most, quote, religious song.
Well, it is it's an overtly religious song. It's a God song.
Yeah, except the imagery in it is not necessarily religious because, the last verse about, the middle verse about the being in the cemetery, the sun is on the cemetery, leaves are on the stones. Never was a place on earth that felt so much like home. Mm. That came because the day after we buried my dad, I got up at 5 in the morning and waited for the Starbucks to open and got coffee and went and sat on his grave and watched the sunrise. The sunrise on his grave. And it was really comforting. I took 2 cups of coffee.
It took his day for a long time.
Yeah, no, for him.
Did, really?
Yeah. And I felt so at peace watching the sunrise rise on his grave. And then that gave me that verse. But then I wanted to go out to, you know, more than just my personal experience, saying I love you like a brother, a father, and a son. And now when I sing that live, I sing I love you all like brothers.
How did that happen?
I don't know, because I feel a lot of peace and, again, love when I sing that song and compassion for people who've lost people.
Mm-hmm.
We should sing God is in the Roses. I should sing it. Would John you? Should play it, though, because I...
Yeah, that'd be great.
Do you want to play it?
Sure.
John usually plays this.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
I don't know how we'll do this, but...
I don't either. I can sit Indian style on the floor.
Just bring your chair
you
over. Are,
or I could move. I could stand.
Oh, no. Trust me, I'm so used to sitting on the living room floor.
That's great.
Oh, man, let it fall.
Do you do yoga?
Don't, but I'm flexible. I am.
Okay, I'm going to recommend that you should start now so you can maintain that.
Yeah. So the reason I asked John to play it, I wrote the song on, you know, like, I wrote it like a little, a folk song. And then when we recorded it, actually Bill Bottrell produced this, you know, he transcended it into something else. Mm. And then John, when he plays it live, transcends it into something else too. Web viewers are going to enjoy this tuning moment.
They will, actually.
All right.
Are we ready?
God is in the roses. Petals and the thorns, the storms out on the oceans, the souls who will be born, and every drop of rain that falls, falls on those who mourn. God is in the roses and the thorns. The sun is on the cemetery, leaves are on the stone. Never was a place on earth that felt so much like home. We're falling like the velvet petals. We're bleeding and we're torn. But God is in the and the thorns. I love you all like brothers. Father and a son, it may not last forever, ever, but it never will be done. My whole world fits inside the moment I saw you be reborn. God is in the roses, and that day was filled with roses. God is in the roses and the thorns.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you both.
Thank you, John.
Oh, I'm so glad you did that.
Well, we were talking a lot about it.
Yeah.
It seemed appropriate.
I kind of know about writing. I wonder if it's true of making an album. I mean, the Black Cadillac album had a lot to do with this period of grieving and mourning and loss. And also healing. It feels like there's healing in there, too. And then you did this earlier album, Interiors, which had to do with the unraveling of your first marriage. Is there a way in which you work through things in the process of getting that music out into the world? Is it?
Well, yes, although I hesitate to say that, because to just think of it as therapy or catharsis diminishes it to me, because, you know, it's supposed to be a work of art and music, and that's beyond therapy. I mean, just to say it's therapy is, you know, it's just narcissism then. But the bigger answer is yes, of course. And a lot of times I don't even know what's going on until I write about it. And sometimes it's even outside of linear time. And then it happens later on. And I say, oh, okay, that's what it's about. That's where, you know, what's happening. That's what's coming up. Yeah, getting it on the written page, finding a melody to put to it, that organizes my life. It keeps me sane.
Right. I guess I imagine that. You put an end to a project like that. I mean, obviously, the loss doesn't end, the mourning doesn't end, but I can imagine that you walk away from that project still different. You've walked through the experience with tools that everyone doesn't have to turn it into art.
Well, I do remember when I was writing the songs for Black Cadillac, feeling really sorry for my sisters that they couldn't write songs, because it gave me a lot of relief. It was just this, you know, intense pain. And to write a song let me know that there was still something alive in it, you know? And God is in the Roses was because in a moment of real mourning and loss, I still felt the presence of light. And I thought, wow, there's this, it's a conundrum, you know, but it exists, that even in the darkest, darkest times, there's this overriding light is the only word I can think of to put to it. I mean, I guess some people would call that God, you know?
So I was pretty interested to see that you have this connection to Celtic music.
Yeah, I love Celtic music.
And it seems to me, I remember talking to John O'Donohue. Did you know him? He was a great Irish poet. Talking to him about this, about how Celtic music, as much as any music I know, kind of conveys that it's all in there, right? There's pain and there's beauty
and murder and
murder and laughter and right, yeah. Right, but it's all somehow contained in the same songs. I also love Ali Bane and Phil Cunningham.
Oh yeah, I love them too.
Yeah. So did that come later? Your father had, Johnny Cash had some roots in Fife.
Well, I do too. I mean,
right.
But
did you discover that? Did he always know that?
No, he found out in the early 80s, and that the Cash name came from Fife in Scotland, and he had the genealogy done. And then, you know, we traced it back to the 12th century. The name began there. Of course, you lose generations along there and people, but it seems that that's where it came from. And definitely by medieval times, you know, the Caches were well rooted there. And then the first Cache left there in the 1600s and came to America. So my dad went there and he just loved this connection. He loved Scotland so much. And he ended up doing this Christmas special there with Andy Williams as the guest the 80s. And it was really cool. And so he gave me the genealogy, the book, and I went to Scotland, and John and I went and toured the palace and, you know, just kind of immersed ourselves in it. And then went and played with Celtic musicians right after that, actually, up in Aberdeen, which was fantastic. So I've been back a few times since then, and I just love it so much. I feel this, I mean, I could be creating all of this, but I really think that you ascribe meaning to what's important in your life, and that's how you create your life. Your life is shaped by what you ascribe meaning to, and I ascribe a lot of meaning to that particular place on earth. So John and I went last summer and played a benefit for the Falkland Trust, which, you know, is takes care of the grounds and the palace, and it's kind of this eco thing too. They're doing organic gardening there too. It's fantastic. So we played this concert, just the two of us, and you know, we had a few thousand people out in the lawn that day, and they were so welcoming, and I felt so much at home. By the last song, I was crying, you know, and then people in front of me started crying. There was just this beautiful moment, like, you know, like the moment with my dad at Carnegie Hall, like where everything is felt, and it's out in the open, and nobody has their guard up or their persona up. It's just all out in the open. And that's one of the best things that music does for me, is it strips away the veneer.
Well, and you, just coming back to this notion of your life being kind of drenched in music.
Yeah.
All your life. And I think Scotland is a place that's drenched in music, right?
It is.
So I can imagine that kinship is more than just genetic.
Well, sure. And then, in the academic way that Celtic music became Appalachian music to Americans and then country music. So we have this straight line back to that music.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, we're talking about this entire time, but I would like to just ask you, how your sense of the meaning of making music, the practice of music, you know, how your sense of that has changed across time. Let's say, I think we're already there, we're already in that, but have there been some other turning points, big realizations?
Well, sure. When I lost my voice for 2.5 years, and that was a huge turning point for me. And, you know, when I said to myself, if I ever get it back, I'm not going to take it for granted anymore. And, you know, I pretty much kept that promise and not to criticize it in my head constantly. And so I've let a lot of that go. But also, this dream I had that, you know, I was in Jungian analysis for 10 years. And it's great for creative people because it's all about mining your dreams and, you know, externalizing things you have in yourself and, you know, kind of making them people and talking to them and all of this great creative work that led to a lot of songs for me. But Jung said that a person will have 5 big dreams in her life. And that dream, there was this dream about art that was my first big dream. Or maybe I had one before that, but in childhood, but I don't know. But it was about seeing Art at a party, this old man named Art. And he turned his back to me and he said, "We don't respect dilettantes." And it crushed me. I woke up from the dream crying. I was crushed. And also really scared that I was leading myself into an ever narrowing kind of corner with my work, and that if I just kept dabbling and, you know, trying to make hit records and not really going deeper into what I did and trying to develop some mastery of it, that it was it. I was going to end up doing parodies of myself. And it woke me up. And I started taking voice lessons and I started painting to see what it felt like to have the absence of words, you know, and to learn what I did in songwriting. I did the same thing in painting. And, you know, I set up all of these kind of lessons for myself. And I've never forgotten that dream or the lesson it imparted. And I'm scared to lose it. I'm scared to dream of Art again and have him turn his back to me.
How old were you when that was happening?
Oh, I was 33.
So you still have 3 big dreams left?
I guess I do.
Wow. And then, of course, you had this brain surgery.
Yeah, I had brain surgery.
That was later.
Yeah, that felt when I finally got diagnosed, I had had headaches for years. When I finally got diagnosed, it felt right when he said, you're going to have surgery. I kind of took just sighed with relief, like, oh, that's right. I kind of knew I was going to this place. And I'm so glad somebody finally knows what's wrong. And it just felt right. That doesn't mean I wasn't scared to mm-hmm. death. I was, but I knew it was the right thing to do. And then I got really, really interested in neuroscience. And
was that the precursor of the fractals? And
no, because I've always been interested in quantum mechanics. And even when I was 24, I kind of had a newborn baby and I marched myself down to the community college to see if I could take a course in quantum physics. And I read lay books on physics that I could understand. And, I have a couple of friends who are physicists and they will deign to dumb down to me and try to explain things to me. Mm-hmm. There's such poetry in quantum physics, though. The language is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the concepts, you know, Schrodinger's cat. Is the cat there? Is he not there? The cat is dead and alive at the
right.
same time.
There's so much creativity
right.
implicit in it.
It's mm-hmm. so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the fractals, that kind of perfection opened my eyes when I first realized that was something that existed. It was almost frightening, like, I can't even grasp this. But science and quantum science particularly, that is like a religion to me, you know? And I started to think, I really believe now that when people talk about heaven, they're talking about a parallel universe.
Right.
But when I had the brain surgery, I did get interested in neuroscience and music, and my friend Dan Levitin, who wrote
your music,
This Is Your Brain,
Brain
on Music, mm-hmm. and The World in Six Songs. You know, we started doing these things at science academies together. He would talk about science and the brain and music, and I would play a couple songs, and we'd talk about my brain surgery. And, you know, I think I had a slightly different perception of music after the surgery.
What? How?
Well, part of it could be just pure physiology because I had a part of the neural signal to my left ear was compressed or compromised in some way, and it got better during the surgery. And the neurosurgeon told me after he was really pleased to see that signal improve. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, I had the hearing of a dog in that ear for like 6 months. It was excruciating. And any sound would really bother me. But that settled down. I'm still sensitive to some frequencies. Actually, my husband knows the exact frequency I'm sensitive to. But something else happened beyond that, the hearing thing. It was as if a layer got removed, and I felt myself able to improvise better and just let myself go into things without trying to control them as much. I think part of that is chronic pain. You know, when you're in chronic pain, you do have kind of a veil over your senses. So that could be it. But there was something more subtle too.
And it was something that you were just immediately aware of after
not immediately,
the surgery.
Not immediately, but mm-hmm. because I didn't play music for a while afterwards. I couldn't stand lyrics for a long time. It became noticeable to me when I did start to play music. So my friend Lisa Randall, who's a theoretical
physicist
at Harvard. So I told her about this and she said, has anyone taken this data down? I said, no, you know, but I have these friends who are neuroscientists who specialize in music. She said, they're not asking you the right questions. She said, anecdotal evidence is really important. They need to, you know, take this down. So Dan and I have been talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, one of the things I didn't want to do when I thought about interviewing you is asking you the questions I think you get asked a lot.
That's okay.
And I really want to talk about you and not your father or your father as of course, he's a huge part of you. But this, the list, you know, is there's been a book written about that the list and you and this in your life. And I just wondered if you would tell a little bit of that story of that and how the importance of it evolved and what that means for you, even as a musician, as a person.
Well, I went on the road with my dad directly after high school. I was 18. And I learned how to play guitar on that tour, that first summer tour I was with him when I was 18. And the Carter family and Carl Perkins were on the road with him as well. And there was time spent in the dressing rooms. And they taught me how to play guitar. And Helen Carter taught me all the Carter family songs. And I was so into it. And I was so into being with my dad for a long extended period after, you know, I was a kid of divorced parents and I spent vacations and some weekends with my dad. And so here I was out with my dad. So, and immersed in his life. And there were long hours on the bus and we would play songs. He would play songs with everyone. And he said to me one day, he said, "Do you know such and such a song?" I said, "No." And he looked a little alarmed. He said, "Do you know this song?" I said, "No." Mm-hmm. Then he got really worried and he spent the rest of the afternoon making a list for me of what he called 100 essential country songs. And he gave me the list and he said, "This is your education." And I wanted it. I think that even if he had given it to me 2 years earlier, I would have been like a teenager, like, "Oh, okay." You know, but I wanted it. I was learning to play guitar. I could sense that he was giving me a huge part of himself. And so I saved the list and I did learn the songs. And I put the list away and I just, wherever I moved, I carried it in my box of letters and memorabilia and didn't think much about it. And in 2006, it was 2004, because my dad had not been dead that long. I was going through my box and I found the list. And I said, "Oh, this is this cool thing Dad gave me. I forgot about this." And then when I wrote the songs for Black Cadillac and we recorded Black Cadillac, I put that into this narrative part of the Black Cadillac show. I said, "When I was 18 years old, my dad made me this list." And then I did a couple of songs from the list. Well, everybody started coming up to me saying, "What about this list? When are you going to record the songs from the list?"
100 songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, as was my natural knee-jerk reaction, I said, no, you know, I don't want to do anything to trade on my dad. It was like my default position my whole life, to my detriment at some point. Mm-hmm. And then after Black Cadillac, it was so intense, such an intense experience emotionally, you know, and to do those songs about mourning and death every night, it was just, I was exhausted at the end of it. And I said, I want to make a cover record next. Okay. And John, my husband, said, "Well, if you're going to make a cover record, it's got to be the list." And it hit me. Well, of course.
Right.
And the other thing that hit me at the same time is that if I didn't claim my own legacy, someone else would co-opt it. It would happen. Mm-hmm. Why was I pushing away this thing that was so essential to my own nature, that was important to my children? It was time to claim it.
Mm-hmm. Was it fun? Was it?
Yeah, it was fun. I was still recovering from brain surgery. So it was, I couldn't spend as long hours in the studio as I usually could. But the songs themselves were, as we said, they were healing and it was exciting.
Do you have a favorite?
From the list?
Yeah. Or maybe the favorite changes.
It does change depending on how I feel. And, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to John because he assembled the record. You know, we talked about which songs were important to record, but he assembled it and arranged it. Because, like I said, I was still sick. I was still recovering. And Long Black Veil was really important to me to record that song because it's so identified with my dad. But my dad and I both identified it with Lefty Frizzell. Okay. But when I was recording it, I kept thinking, oh my God, if Dad could hear me sing Long Black Veil, he would fall over. He wouldn't believe it. He would be so happy.
Isn't there a Mick Jagger version of that too?
Oh, I'm sure there is. A lot of people have recorded it.
That's the one that I had in my head.
Yeah.
Would you want to? Yeah, we need to change tapes.
Okay.
And then I want to just kind of draw to a close, but maybe after we're finished, you could sing one of maybe that or
okay.
something else from the list.
Something from the list. Okay. We're changing tapes, yeah.
We're changing tapes, you do.
You know, on my Twitter page,
yes,
my profile says that I'm a Episcopalian.
I know. Don't talk about it yet. We're going to get there. See, this is why I don't like to be sitting together when we're not actually...
Don't say anything.
Bring out the mouth clamp.
Yeah, no, I'm like the husband who doesn't want to see the bride before the wedding because something will happen.
It's so cute. You're very good at this, by the way. Like top 1%.
Well, thank you.
You've refined your skills.
Well, yeah, although after I wrote a book and I got interviewed myself, I realized how low that bar is. I
mean,
there's a lot of bad interviews out there, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Hadn't noticed.
I mean, you know, what I've said also is, what I learned is, it's really hard to transcend a stupid question or a simplistic, right? If you get asked a simplistic question, it elicits a simplistic answer. If you get asked an inflammatory question, it elicits.
Right. You know, somebody told me, they said, you never have to answer the question you're asked, which I hate with politicians.
Right.
But...
there's a reason.
Yeah. But if you want to transcend it, like you said, you...
But it's hard. It's tricky.
Yeah.
Are we...
waiting for John.
Oh, waiting for John. Okay.
Do you want some more water?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. Thanks, Nancy.
No, I'm good. Thanks. Yeah. I'll take that. No. I put this in my writer.
I know.
So awesome.
I haven't gotten into that yet.
That's good, thanks.
Okay. So let's talk about Twitter. This is another thing. Are you surprised? Well, first of all, none of us would ever have imagined Twitter.
No.
But this has become... I would say, especially with you, you have a big Twitter presence. It's a big part of your public persona.
Yeah, I don't do Facebook. I mean, the record label does. I don't go on there. Twitter seems perfect for me. It's, you know, 140 characters. As Mike Doty says, it's boot camp for songwriters. If you can say it succinctly and somewhat poetically or with humor in 140 characters, that's great for refining the skills as a songwriter. And also, I mean, much more than that, the cafe society that Twitter is so wonderful. I have met, you know, professor of philosophy, other musicians, writers, moms, doctors, tons of media people. It's really great. And I've learned a lot and made real friends, you know?
Yeah, right. And that's a little bit counterintuitive And also, what's interesting to me is people often use the words brainy and Twitter with you in the same sentence. And I wonder, just as you say that, I wonder if it's partly because you, it's this art of songwriting that...
Well, yeah, also because I'm a geek and I like really geeky things. Like they posted a periodic table that was interactive. I just was on that like a game forever. Uh-huh. And, you know, the whole Jane Austen thing, I try out my Jane Austen persona on Twitter, which is really fun. And that also helps hone language too. And mm-hmm. I love language. Mm-hmm. It's fun. And the one of the really fun things that has happened in Twitter recently is I met this woman who is a knitting teacher and she writes knitting books, Kay Gardner, and I asked her to give me a lesson. So I learned how to knit from Twitter.
Did you do it on Twitter? Or
no,
you,
she's
you then
come,
had to connect.
Right. We first met in a coffee
Twitter.
Shop so I could make sure she wasn't a psycho.
Yeah.
And then she came to my house.
And you do describe yourself there as a neo-folk Buddhiscopalian. Pagan, post-feminist, progressive. Did I get it right?
Yeah, that almost covers it.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I put progressive on there so that some of these people who follow me who expect me to be something different don't get a nasty surprise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot. Some of it is just kind of tweaking people. But Buddhiscopalian is actually... kind of close to what I feel myself to be religious in religious terms. Buddhist because I actually studied more about Buddhism than I did any other religion, and it makes the most sense to me. Self-awareness, compassion, nonviolence.
It's also
what
that
else?
Impermanence that we talked
the
about.
The impermanence,
earlier.
Right. Performance, right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, compassion, nonviolence. What else do you need in a religion? I don't need to play team sports in a religion. And Episcopal because my girls went to an Episcopal school and I love the church. It's in Greenwich Village and they do a lot of outreach to gay, homeless, young people. So that's a progressive church. They're mm-hmm. very ecumenical.
There's somewhere that you use this phrase, the pantheon of my religious desires, yeah. which is also another way of... evoking yeah. that list.
Yeah, religious capital R, not religious as in religion so mm-hmm. much as in that great expanse of creativity and spirituality that is all the same thing to me. Mm-hmm. And I want so much to touch those things in my life and in my work, and I just keep looking for the veil to be lifted, even in a fraction of a moment, you know, I'm always looking for that. That's my religious desire.
Is mystery a word you use?
Carefully. I use the word mystery carefully. There are mysteries, you know, fractals are a mystery, and songwriting is somewhat mysterious. There are mysterious moments. And I like living with the questions mm-hmm. rather than the answers. Tom Waits said this great thing about songwriting. He said he was driving in a car and he got on the freeway and he got an idea for a song. And it was just, you know, like overwhelming him, the idea for this song. And he couldn't get a pencil and there was no paper and he's on the freeway. And he finally just looked up at the sky and said, "Don't you see I'm driving?" And I feel that way sometimes too. Don't you see I'm getting my child off to school or helping with homework or, you know, just trying to be available.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think is really intriguing in your stories that I want to ask you about is the sense of place in your life in music. I mean, you were born in Memphis, but then you moved to California. Mm-hmm. But what's more obvious is this Nashville, New York axis.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really two different universes in this culture.
Well, I spent much longer in California and I have spent much longer in New York than I ever did in Nashville. I only lived mm-hmm. in Nashville 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Although it's kind of the homeland of a lot of the music
right.
that you're associated with.
True. And I had a lot of hit records there. But I never felt comfortable I felt comfortable in the community of songwriters. There were great songwriters there, and that was exciting, you know, to hear what somebody had written and to go to their house and hear what they were writing right then and to trade songs. That was fantastic. But the marketing and the whole industry, I felt very uncomfortable in.
Mm-hmm. And then I also think of this in this sense of place category. You went and sang at Folsom Prison, you and John, this March 2011.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was a time travel experience, too. Some of these experiences that have a sense of mystery about them like that have something to do with time travel. It's so strange. We went there. They asked us to come to mm-hmm. speak, to play for and to speak with their music and art program. And in maximum security. And so we went, and we played some songs for them. They played some songs for us. A couple people read poems. They asked questions. You know, it was a true give and take. And they had been very carefully vetted, the men who came to this. And it was very moving. Hmm. And one man said to me, you know, my father recorded this famous record at Folsom.
Right.
He also recorded a very famous record at San Quentin. And one man said to me when we were there, he said, "I was at San Quentin when your dad recorded the album. And now he's at Folsom."
Right.
So he spent virtually his entire life in prison. And he, you know, that in itself was very moving. Then the guards took us over to the old dining hall, the old prison where my dad had recorded the album. Oh, that was a moment out of time. I just can't tell you the feeling of that. It was time travel. Hmm.
I have to say, I watched a little bit of it on YouTube, and
there's some of it on YouTube.
Yeah, it's just a snippet. But what I noticed, I mean, I saw how moving it was for you, which you're describing now. But they also would pan to the men's faces, you know? I mean, they were just soaking this up, right?
Well, I was too, you know? And one guy said to me, he said, "Could you ever imagine being in my place?" And I said, "Man, some days you have more internal freedom than I do." Mm. And it's so true. So true. We create our own prisons, don't we?
Mm. Wow. So, I don't know, that just happened not too long ago.
In March.
Yeah.
We went through a monsoon to get there. It was like the first monsoon in California in, I don't know, 100 years or something.
Mm-hmm. I want to just end by just asking, you know, what you're thinking about now. Where do you see the veil lifting in unexpected places now?
I think about my children and how I'm the middle of this ongoing story of my family. I'm not the end of it. And I'm interested in what they're going to do. One of them is a musician. Mm-hmm. And one, you know, I still have a young child at home, my son, who's 12. And every single moment with this kid is precious to me. Because there's no wall between me and my own mortality anymore. You know, both my parents are gone, and I feel this urgency to complete the things I want to complete. And in the same way, I just feel like I'll never read all the books I want to read in this lifetime. I'll never complete all of the projects and write all the songs I want to write. So I started taking music theory again and piano lessons, just so maybe it'll be a doorway to go deeper into something. And I feel more excited about it than I did when I was 14.
Hmm. I think that's your last word. Anything else?
Well, a song.
Yeah, a song.
Do you want me to play some?
What do you want to?
Do you want something from the list, or you want something else? You get to.
What do you feel like? Oh, I don't know. I don't want to. I actually felt when I was getting ready to talk to you, I didn't. There's so many songs, right? There's so many songs. And I was wondering what was most meaningful for you. And it must be interesting in your position that some of your songs are big hits. Some of the songs, what is it, Seven Year Ache, that everyone mm-hmm. mentions in the first breath.
Yeah.
But then you must have songs that are more, you know, I think about how the eye, and you've talked about this too, the eye for a writer or songwriter is not necessarily autobiographical. Yeah. But there must be songs that are more pieces of truth about who you yeah. are, who you were then.
Right. Right, and also my interpretation is not necessarily your interpretation of my own song. Shall I move this up?
I just didn't want you to say something really interesting.
Well, I'm going to do The World Unseen. This is also from Black Cadillac, and there, the first line, I'm the sparrow on the roof, is from the Psalms. And in the last few months of my dad's life, I read the Psalms to him. And I don't think I ever realized how poetic the Psalms were. And then there, this line about being a sparrow on the roof just killed me. So after my dad died, I wanted to start the song that way.
I'm the sparrow on the roof. I'm the list of everyone I have to lose. I'm the rainbow in the dirt. I am who I was and how much I can hurt. I will look for you in stories of the kings. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen. In morphine and in dreams. my bloodstream. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen.
Thank you, Roseanne Cash.
Thank you.
Wow, what a pleasure.
Okay. Yeah. Have to give you a hug.
Oh, I'm sorry to tear you up there.
No, it's a good day if I cry.
I don't think there was much out there about that, false imprisonment visit.
You didn't know there was much?
I mean, there wasn't a lot of publicity. No, wasn't a lot online. I kind of stumbled on it.
There was a TV news coverage of it.
That's it.
They
didn't.
Local.
They weren't allowed to film them in.
Yeah, we didn't make a big deal.
It was like 3 minutes on YouTube. It was just a snippet of you singing, and they showed them.
I think it was a feature from the Folsom TV. Yeah, because they taped the whole thing, actually. So it exists if you ever wanted it. You know, it's heavy.
Yeah.
It's a deeply compelling philosophical, ethical, moral vortex.
John had trouble with it at first, you know, because we were going into guys who'd done the worst things.
Except they're showing the best part of themselves. Yeah, right. So it just evens itself out immediately. You know,
these are not guys who held up gas stations.
Yeah.
These guys did the worst things you could think of. It's very... I mean, the guards... very placid demeanor, but they have nothing but contempt for these guys.
Right.
Yeah, but the treatment still is not good.
These guys had some spark in their rehabilitation and regret, or they wouldn't have been in the art.
Their
eyes were bright, right? They were just taking it all in with such joy.
And this guy's poems. Remember the guy's
poems? Oh, yeah, the poems and the blues guy, the old L.A. blues guy. Incredible.
Amazing. Do people go exhausted when they leave? Yes.
Does anyone need tickets? You let me know, Susan, you two from the staff. Just text or call me, because we have some extra tickets.
I think
you
should have them somewhere after
you don't get them.
Do you edit it to an hour or 15
minutes?
We
edit it to an hour, and we'll be able to put some music on there. It'll
how long was it? Like 75?
I actually decided to push it in because I knew we would cut very much.
That's true.
You know what? I'm going to get my cell phone and get a picture of us and tweet it. Are you kidding? All of my followers knew I was doing this and they were excited. They wanted to
Now I can't make it. If I see what she does, I would have heart. I can't even go on Twitter.
Yeah, I never. Let's put it this way. I never, ever look at her Twitter.
Oh,
I
don't want
to. We can't. It's too near and
distorted. That's how people.
No, I don't think she did that, but it's a sign of her. The Twitter personality is not necessarily the person I'm married.
Oh, really? That's interesting. You should go back to that.
True. I don't know about that.
Okay.
I mean, she has a vibrant public persona. Mm-hmm. You don't marry the public persona.
Yeah.
Voters, you know, places where they cross pollinate.
But it is. It gets curious though when one Twitter response from a fan base becomes
seriously
important issue.
Right.
You know, like she'll get one response and it's not someone she knows, so it's just general.
But she takes it in.
But then she takes
it
in.
We're
it
like,
time.
But honey, how do you know it's not
we
like
have
a 49?
Decisions over the head. You won't even make decisions when I give you stats of 100,000 requests. Because it doesn't mean anything.
Right, and we're like, Rose, how do you know this person isn't
weird.
A 250-pound, 49-year-old man living in the basement of his parents' house in St. Louis.
And claiming to be married.
Like, what? What? Why are we drinking this? Way too much information.
You're not going to believe this. I left my phone at my hotel, so you have to take it and send it to me, and then I'll see it.
There you go.
I just bought an iPhone.
You just took a little away and
I'll back it up too.
A redhead photo.
Yeah.
I just bought my iPhone in Minneapolis today.
Okay.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Those paparazzis are so good.
They are all paparazzi.
Well, you know what? I mean, this for the iPhone, this is the light is way too bright.
Oh, okay.
You guys,
it is?
Yeah.
All right, let's step out.
I prefer dim light.
Oh, no, maybe I should put it on auto.
Let's get really flat.
Oh, now we need
to. Oh, that's much better from
there.
Is it flattering? Because that's harsh.
I don't know. Look, I don't know what I'm doing.
Ours is almost there.
We can send you copies from the thick, you know.
Yeah, that's...
mine's flashing. Why is mine flashing? I don't want
it to flash. I just want my wedges because I don't want him to... I just want to put it off as long as I can.
I know, it's heartbreaking.
Hold on, ladies.
The pediatrician told me that. She said...
That's better. Okay.
She said the moms really have a hard time when the boys get taller.
Yeah, it's just... I'm probably gonna.
Oh, it's too bright.
Well, then again, why don't you use the real picture?
Okay, look, he's the perfect husband.
You can
even. Not only does he play the guitar,
no.
The other thing, he knows when you're not gonna like a picture.
Oh, that part's a no-brainer.
Let's try this.
I think that's special.
No, well, you
try this
job. Sometimes it's amazing.
Is that better?
Are you going to tweet the photo?
I can't see without my glasses anyway.
Not bad. They're not
glamour
shots.
No.
Party
it's work.
It's
showing up.
It's light.
Send it to me.
Oh,
right.
This was such a great adventure.
Oh, it was a great adventure for me, too. Thank you. Are you coming to the show?
You know, I wish I were. Trent is coming. It's tomorrow night. Why did I have this feeling? What is tomorrow night?
Oh, just come to Fargo then.
Yeah. Okay, if I don't, I will come next week.
There will be a next time, too. It seems like I play here every 6 weeks.
Wow, what is this?
Thanks, everyone.
That's just an iPod Touch app.
Oh,
with a clock app.
Oh, God, it scares us. Why is there this attached to this?
Because I take it.
What could that possibly be?
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh,
it was
a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
It's
really my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Great to meet you. All right, likewise.
Thank
pleasure
you
to meet
for
you.
Also
good luck.
Entertaining.
Oh,
the,
yeah, you're 99. You're 99.
Streamers, yeah.
Crazy people who love
I hope so. Thank you.
Is there anything else we can help you with here?
No.
You find your way and...
No. We're
going
to go
to
eat. Yeah.
Thank
you.
Have a great show.
Thank you.
I said, you know, that's...
Another thing.
Right, right.
Okay.
All right,
man,
it's
good work.
Thank you for having me.
Can you
see
you tomorrow?
Yeah, actually, I'll be up in the booth.
Oh, good. Oh, you're working. Yeah, I got to set this. At least a tentative one.
Oh, that's very helpful.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's what we're working on. We might change the rehearsal, but it's going to be close because the orchestra songs are absolutely
yeah. Yeah, right. And well, and
you can record
this. We're not recording that anyway. So
can you record any of her singing of the song she's doing with the orchestra and the orchestra's not playing? Or you just can't
sure.
record?
No, it's literally, it's a unique thing. So the musicians can't be recorded unless they get paid to be recorded. So
right.
We're not recording.
But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like she sings verses in the songs with orchestra that the orchestra's not playing when she's singing.
Sure. Oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Or can you not even just record that song because it's off limits?
No, as long as there's no orchestra to that we use in any way.
Well, just think about that. I was just thinking, because she's saying we're all unseen here.
Yeah.
And she's doing it with the orchestra. But there might be a way where you play both.
We're really hoping to capture like some story and some audience.
Yeah.
That kind of
I got a word in that. See you, everyone.
Take care. Bye. Yeah, on the next
I'm still feeding you.
That was great.
Well, we are going to make it.